The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. The return of football, the return of not being able to make the VAR chat stop, and the return of a carefully worded intro. So the Premier League fixture list is out and it's live, all of it. How many games in a row will you watch? We'll round up all you need to know ahead of Project Restart, and we'll also discuss how well or not the EFL is managing things ahead of the return of the Championship, the end of League Two, and the whatever they decide to do with League One. Archie will round up the Bundesliga and tell us exactly what Chelsea should expect from Timo Werner. And Ed Ahrens has written a book, Made in Africa. We will talk about that. All that plus your questions on today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, author Ed Ahrens is here. Hello, Ed. How are you doing?
I'm very good, thanks, Max. And you?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. The book is The History of African Players in English Football. I'm enjoying it. I'm about halfway through right now. Made in Africa, it's called. We'll discuss it in part three, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely, yeah. Look forward to it.
In the acknowledgements, you credit Nick Ames. Hello, Nick.
Hi, I'm embarrassed. Yeah.
Well, how much credit do you deserve for Ed writing this book?
I deserve a lot for being nutmegged by a five-year-old kid in Mo Salah's home village and providing a healthy dose of the humour of the book.
That is in the book.
I know.
Could you have defended that situation better, do you think?
Yeah, I think I left myself a bit wide open, but it was a very bubbly pitch. It was an almost unplayable surface, and my legs were like a sort of Bruce Grobbelaar spaghetti man trying to keep my feet on there. So no blame attached to anybody.
Also, it says making up the panel here, Philippe, but that is underselling Philippe Auclair, isn't it? Hi, mate, how are you?
I'm not too bad, thank you very much. But that was overselling it. As well.
Now, can I start with some Football Weekly news? Guardian Football Weekly has decided to go three times a week, Mondays, Tuesdays and Thursdays. Barry has reacted to this extra workload by taking four podcasts off, which is... I imagine how he would react. But with the return of the Premier League, we feel that there is enough to talk about to do three podcasts a week. No plans to go daily, of course. That would be overkill, wouldn't it? So we'll be back Mondays, Tuesdays and Thursdays for you. I hope that is good news for listeners. If you find two is too many, then I send my apologies. Let's start then with the Premier League. All systems go for Project Restart. The Premier League's confirmed the first three round of fixtures. The sixth round of twice weekly screening found zero positives from a total of 1,195 players and clubs staff tested for COVID-19. The TV schedule has been released. All remaining 92 Premier League matches will be broadcast live in the UK by Sky, BT Sport, Amazon Prime, and the BBC, with 5 Live and TalkSport providing live commentaries on every game. Obviously starts 6 p.m. 17th of June, Aston Villa, Sheffield United, Man City hosting Arsenal, 8:15 that day. Philippe, it is an extraordinary amount of football. How do you feel about it coming back, and will you watch every minute of it?
I won't, that's for sure. I'm surprised. I have yet to hear a good reason why every single game is being shown. I must say I don't quite understand the rationale, but I don't understand the rationale of so many things at the moment. I mean, I haven't been exactly sitting on the fence when it comes to Project Restart myself. And I've got my doubts about it, about the way things have been done, but it is restarting. It's wonderful, I suppose, to have football back, even though in this very strange fashion. But one thing that I'm already thinking of is how the changes we are seeing now, and we will see from Wednesday onwards, Wednesday the 17th, that is, how many of those will be permanent changes? If in a way this is not a way to try out to enroll various models which might or might not stay in place later or got back to later, if you see what I mean.
So one of your fears would be, for example, they're showing games at 3 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon.
For example, yes, or that the games are staggered in such a way. If it works and the viewing figures are great, which they will be for the start, certainly. It would be interesting to see, by the way, what the figures are when, in the 3 or 4 rounds on, when we have mid-table clashes which are shown on their own. To be quite interested to see how many people are actually tuning in to see that, to watch that. I can see that there is a kind of logic of there is no sport, people are hungry for sport, people are hungry for football, so let's give them as much as possible. But there is also, at the moment, I feel, it in a way it enhances the bubble-like nature of the Premier League. As in, everything is different for the Premier League. So we're going to have all these games being played at staggered times. We have all these changes with the substitutions as well, and the number of people on the bench, and we carry on and on. And you think, wow, this is like an experiment in real time. Like, it's almost as if these very strange circumstances enabled to try out various things, which might not necessarily be for the greater good of football. That's just a personal and not particularly well-articulated point of view, I'm afraid, Max. I'm just wondering what exactly is happening. And I'm a bit worried, as we are all worried when we enter a terra incognita.
Nick, you're nodding.
Yeah, I feel a mixture of excitement, sort of professionally and more widely, and also apprehension, I think. I'm very interested in whether this is going to take off for the viewers in the long term, which I think is a point Philippe has just touched on. And obviously we can add in there the measures that might be being taken to attract viewers or keep them, like the crowd being piped in and fans, cardboard cutouts around the stands and that kind of thing. But I just think there is a big risk that if this isn't compelling and if it isn't an engrossing, wonderful spectacle that keeps people, you know, on the edge of their seats all summer, then it leaves a bit of a funny taste in the mouth, and football suddenly is on maybe on the back foot a bit as the sort of all-embracing, all-encompassing entertainment behemoth that it has been for so many years. And I think they've got to be very careful about how it is packaged, because otherwise, you know. And it's a slightly basic point to make. Football's popularity could be at risk, especially if fans can't go in the stadiums for quite a long time. So they're kind of damned if they do and damned if they don't, aren't they?
Yeah.
Like, I think if you put football in cold storage for 6 months, that is arguably even worse, obviously, because people's habits change and what people are interested in doing changes. Like, I like going for walks in my local area a lot more than I did 3 months ago, you know. genuinely, like, I found parks and forests that I didn't know existed within literally 10 minutes of my front door, because most of the time at the weekend I'm working or I'm at a football match. But I think they've got to make sure that the way it comes across and how it's produced and how it's packaged is in a way that people want to keep coming back and back and back, and that it's not just a novelty for one weekend. And I think in Germany that has gone fairly well. I mean, I've watched a few games in Germany, and I've not minded it without the artificial crowd noise, to be honest. I've got doubts about that, but maybe we'll come to it. But as you say, when there's less riding on the games, like, I think isn't BBC's first game Palace Bournemouth? Is that right? Something like that, and that's going to be free to air. The first free to air Premier League game.
What more could you want?
I know you're a Palace, you're a Palace fan, Ed, aren't you? And like I looked at all the fixtures. I thought the day I'm going to crack is Crystal Palace Burnley on Monday, June the 29th on Amazon. I might just go, you know, whoever's hosting that 2 hours before kickoff, who has to really wind up the entertainment, that they've got a job on, haven't they?
If it's a sunny day, they're in trouble, aren't they? But yeah, I think, I mean, that point that the BBC are going to show games for the first time, like that Nick just said at the end there, and even though it is Palace first, not the most attractive game, but that's a massive landmark for the Premier League, although I really doubt it's ever going to happen again after this. So, you know, that's one of the changes, that one of the good positive changes that almost immediately you can rule out that we won't see again, you know, unfortunately. And I think, and as Philippe mentioned, that is my big concern, that the 3 p.m. kickoffs will just cease to exist. And, you know, the rule that we've had for however long television's been around, basically, always, but, you know, you can't broadcast games live on Saturday at 3 o'clock. It was designed to protect the match-going fan, you know, which are the root of English football, with people like that go every week, not just to the Premier League, but to clubs, you know, in the lower leagues and outside the league as well. And I think that's under real, real threat if the end of the 3 p.m. ban, because it looks like that might be, like Philippe said, these staggered kickoffs, and people were just going to get used to it and want football all the time like they do already. You know, we've already seeing pretty much every night of the week now is given over to football, isn't it? We've had the introduction of Friday night football and Saturday night football, different times on Sundays, you know, more slots to spread the games out. And, you know, we all love football, obviously, but I think, and I'm really looking forward to it coming back, but it might just be a bit of overkill with, you know, in with certain games. Not every game has to be live, does it? But I can understand why they've done that now, because I think there's a lot of worry from the clubs about having to pay some of this TV money back. The more matches they can get on live TV, then the more they can say to the broadcasters, look, why should we have to pay any of the money back? And that will solve their financial problems. So I think that's the main driver.
Yeah, I think, Philip, there's something interesting about, you know, I think it's something like half of our listeners are not in the UK. They're in Australia, America, all over the world. And certainly, you know, for US sports, they can watch whatever game they want. And also, in the US or in Australia, I think you can watch every single Premier League game. So they might be listening to this thinking, it's strange that the people in that country, and I think maybe we all feel it because of what we're used to consuming, are actually not pro every game being on.
Mm. I mean, first, two things. First thing is that we were talking about the Bundesliga, and the Bundesliga has been, I think, a success, the restart of the Bundesliga. The Bundesliga is not staggering all the games. I mean, next Saturday, there are five games kicking off at 2:30 on Saturday in the Bundesliga. You know, they haven't done that. And the other thing which has got to do with what you're saying about, it's true that you can watch in France, for example, you can watch almost every single Premier League game live or staggered or whatever. You could watch every single game. The thing is that one thing that, and I'm talking here as a foreigner precisely, one thing I love about English football is the fact that English football is not just the Premier League, is that English football is a whole pyramid, and that there's a genuine feeling of a pyramid in which games are from the 7th or the 8th division carry a lot of importance for the people of the local area. And it's what we lose. The risk for me is to lose this idea that it is a pyramid and that only the tip of the pyramid is actually of importance. And that we're setting a precedent with this staggered kickoffs and showing absolutely everything. It's like there are two parallel universes. One of them is elite football and the rest is, well, what do you call it? I don't know what to call it anymore. And if you lose that relationship, for me, you lose something absolutely crucial in what makes English football so special. That is a worry. Maybe this worry is completely misplaced, and when amateur football can restart and when League Two football can restart and National League can restart, everything will go back to sort of normal, so to speak. But I fear that won't be the case. It just, for me, enhances the artificial nature of creating a super elite, which is, in a way, completely cut from the rest of football. I don't like that.
Mm. Yeah, and especially at a time when really is the... We're going to talk about this, I think, later as well, but the clubs lower down the pyramid are the ones that are really suffering from this. And the full extent of it, we haven't seen it yet, but, I mean, we're starting to see a little bit of players being released by you know, previously quite not successful, but, you know, doing well in their relative divisions, and players being released because the clubs just know that they can't afford them for next season and having to cut their cloth already. And it's really sad that kind of polarisation of the game. And like Philippe says, you know, there's as many, almost, well, there used to be as many supporters of all the other small clubs out there as the big clubs. But now, you know, that's eroding away and people don't support their local club as much as they used to anymore, unfortunately, because of the way it's going. And I think that would be a really sad thing if we lost, you know, any of the 92 clubs and some of the ones below as well, because that's what the top clubs really should be trying to help, you know, get through this. But obviously financial issues come first for them because they are businesses.
And what about women's football in there as well?
Women's football, of course, absolutely.
Completely forgotten.
And I think, it touches on some stuff we'll talk about later, I think, but it's not a surprise that the Championship have rushed their start through to be on the same weekend as the Premier League season, with quite a lot of that televised as well, because these guys know what side their bread's buttered on.
A question from Brendan. Does the panel agree with clubs using artificial crowd noise during behind closed doors matches? What noises would you prefer to be played? The sound of Formula One, some classic Enya, a Peter Griffin laugh with each misplaced pass by the away team. I think it was you, Nick, who said, I mean, I watching the Bundesliga, I've just had to like different noises, and the noise of a footballer kicking a football is nice. I don't know if I need... I don't know if I need it to be made artificial, but I, you know, if they are going to put in sound effects, I'd quite like them to be funny.
Well, I'm quite interested. Like, I was thinking at the weekend, like how personally will I react, like professionally, to reporting on a game where there's no real sense of occasion, no background, no noise, no nothing. How much when you're writing a match report are you actually responding to the occasion and the framing of it and how the context affects you? And how much are you actually responding to the nuts and bolts of what happens in front of you? So I think that's going to be interesting. And then in terms of the act of watching a match, I put a couple of the Bundesliga games on yesterday. And, you know, it's I think it's quite clever how they're doing it. Like, I think when Dortmund were at home, actually, the other week they had specific Dortmund chants on, didn't they? And they're tailoring it according to who is at home and what kind of atmosphere there is. But that is not the game that's going on. The game on the pitch is not responsive to any of that. And okay, if it keeps people happy and gives them this feeling of reality and normality, then I get it. And if it keeps people watching and keeps people interested, I get that even further. And I think it's really important. But personally, it's absolutely not for me because it's not real. And I want to be looking and thinking and talking about something that's real. I know that makes me sound really boring, and I'm all for some and I'm all for some Peter Griffin laughter or some Benny Hill music or something like that. But in terms of piped in crowd noise, nah. Like, let's just do it.
Nick Ames only wants real things. He wants facts. It reminds me of when I was on the radio with Didi Haman. He said he didn't like fiction. Full stop. But he did.
Wow.
But he did like The Lion King, which I said explained wasn't a documentary. I think he knew. He's quite fun to work with, to be fair. Some actual football happened. There were some friendlies over the weekend. At Old Trafford, Harry Maguire captained a home Manchester United team against an away team led by Bruno Fernandes, refereed by fitness coach Charlie Owen. Arsenal beat Charlton 6-0. Eddie Nketiah scoring a second-half hat-trick, in addition to goals from Lacazette, Aubameyang and Joe Willock. Aston Villa drew 2-2 with West Brom, and it finished Newcastle United 1. A goal from Joe Linton, though.
It's typical Joe Linton. We'd wait for a friendly yeah. of Newcastle versus Newcastle to score.
a decision on the neutral venues, a decision on the Merseyside derby on the 21st of June is expected later today. That and Man City Liverpool are the only fixtures that might be at neutral venues in the lead up until the 2nd of July. Elsewhere, Chelsea have agreed to sign Timo Werner from RB Leipzig. He'd been previously linked with Liverpool. We'll discuss that with Archie in part two. Now, Philippe, Manchester City and the Court of Arbitration for Sports. It will begin today. It's expected to last 3 days. How closely will you be following this case?
I would like to follow it much more closely than I'm going to, because unfortunately all the proceedings are going to be behind closed doors. What we know is that three arbitrators have been designated. The way it works is that each party designates one arbitrator. You choose it, and then Cass has a third one. We shouldn't expect, by the way, a verdict to be reached at the end of the week or anything like that. No, it might take a very long time. It's already been delayed quite a bit because we were hoping at one point for the case to be heard in March, and it's only now. So in June, I believe we're in June, Max. So we can expect a verdict later, much later in the summer. And in fact, a verdict not that long before UEFA starts the 2020-2021 Champions League. That's where we are right now. But unfortunately, as far as the proceedings are concerned, we can only guess at the moment. My guess is that Manchester City will question the right of actually UEFA to consider some evidence. I mean, that seems to be pretty much the line that they're going to take. They're going to contest the fact that the decision taken by UEFA was based on documents which were obtained through hacking. I would imagine that's going to be the basis of their defense. Whereas UEFA would say, well, the facts are completely incontrovertible and this is the truth. You know, this is what happened. There was financial doping at work here, as well as genuine lack of cooperation, and which is why normally it would have been a 1 year ban. This is a 2 year ban. So this is where we are now. I expect there will be a few leaks from interested parties at some point in the proceedings, but we shouldn't expect an open verdict before at least, I think, a couple of months, if not much more, if not more than that.
And that's going to have quite a knock-on effect on an already very disrupted and truncated Premier League season. Like, you've got a lot of clubs for whom, slightly unfortunately, given the wider situation, there is a lot at stake here in terms of, are we getting to the Champions League? Are we getting to the Europa League? Then there'll be a very quick turnaround, we presume, until next season. And, you know, if Arsenal sneak into fifth place and Mikel Arteta's talking about he's got his plan A, B, C for pre-season, you're going to have about 5 minutes to execute one of them when you find out where you are. I mean, that is not the fault of the process, because I think we are where we are in terms of the pandemic and the new schedule. But it's going to have some quite wide ramifications, isn't it?
It will, and also on the transfer market, because a lot will depend on the severity of the punishment. If indeed a two-year ban is upheld, you can be absolutely sure that quite a few players will be starting to look elsewhere. And also, it would be much, much more difficult for Manchester City, of course, to attract top talent if you say to this top talent, well, here you are, you won't play in Europe for two seasons. That's going to be very, very tough. So the ramifications are huge. And to be honest, at the moment, we are very much in a kind of still virtual reality in a way, because we still don't know. UEFA still hasn't announced the dates for the final eight. We don't really know what's going to happen. And as you said, Nick, the ramifications are going to be huge in both ways. Because should Manchester City be able to convince CAS that the evidence which has been used by UEFA was not evidence which should have been used, this is the death knell for financial fair play. We know that.
Very interesting point there, Philippe, because I've done quite a lot of stuff on this about Rui Pinto and, you know, the person, the football leaks and everything. And just looking into some precedents of this, there have been occasions where CAS has allowed evidence which is obtained illegally, if you like. And there's been a couple of cases where they've permitted it. And that does seem to be like it's going to be City's biggest, you know, strongest defence of this.
Only defence.
Only defence. And you know, it's there in black and white, isn't it, really? So it's not looking that great for them. But, you know, they have a lot of money and some pretty good lawyers, so there could be some loopholes there, you know. And it's going to be hard for them in this climate to impose the 2 year ban. I hope they, you know, I kind of hope that they do in a way, because if they're going to have rules, they have to, you know, stick by them. But I just think it's going to be really quite a real test to see of CAS, to see, you know, which way they go on.
And do forgive me, I know I'm not the only one, but when anyone says this is a big decision for CAS, I instantly think Tony Cascarino is making all these decisions. And it's quite a lot of pressure on CAS. We were talking about the financial issues across English football. Spurs have borrowed £175 million from the British government to help cope with the financial impact of the coronavirus. Both Spurs and the Bank of England confirmed it on Thursday that an agreement had been reached as part of the government's COVID corporate financing facility. Strict criteria applies to be eligible for the initiative, including holding the highest credit rating possible for a firm, with the money repayable in full not before April 2021 at an interest rate of just 0.5%. Spurs stated the money will not be used for player acquisitions, and instead ensure the club has financial flexibility and additional working capital, while also helping repay the debt of their 1 billion stadium. I mean, I don't know if any of you know the answer to this. Does that mean they can't buy anyone at all? You know, this money, can they use money from somewhere else to buy someone? It's fascinating.
I must say I'm a bit flabbergasted. Any club worth its salt is going to use this opportunity, isn't it? If you can borrow at 0.5%, do it, guys. Absolutely.
Lots of clubs there's been a real trend in the last year or two of clubs, you know, using these kind of investment funds to fund transfers. You know, like we saw it with João Felix and with Antoine Griezmann in the summer, using the company where they, you know, I think that's something like 7.5% and up their interest rate. I know we don't want to talk about interest rates too much, but comparing that to what they were doing to what is now available, then you'd have thought that some clubs might try and use that to their advantage if they can. But there probably isn't any regulation of it. So,
and I think it shores up their position very well, doesn't it? Because I think they made the biggest profit before tax out of every Premier League club in 18-19 by quite a long way. I think it was around 140 million, something like that. So I guess they will feel that it bolsters their position in a way that other leading clubs, you know, Arsenal, for example, cannot do.
Finally, for part one, Philippe, what's the latest on the Newcastle takeover?
It's absolutely fascinating.
You've got a minute, Philippe.
I've got a minute, okay. I've been saying for 2 months that it was not going to happen, and to general laughter in the room. And it might happen. I mean, there's possibility. Unfortunately for the people who are trying to buy Newcastle at the moment, I mean, there is a real impasse, because whichever way, and the Premier League is placed here in a situation between the hammer and the anvil, we say in French. So whatever decision it takes, it's going to annoy some very important people an awful lot, because it is a fact that the World Trade Organization report is linking directly the Saudi regime and therefore Mohammed bin Salman and therefore the investment fund, the sovereign fund, to the operation of BeOutQ, the pirate television channel. So that is a fact. So how on earth can you then turn to one of your best clients, Qatar, beIN Sport, which has the rights of broadcasting in the Arab world of the Premier League since 2013, and tell them, well, you know, those guys who've been bootlegging, that's no problem, they can buy a club. And so that's, whichever way you look at it, it's an impossible situation for Richard Masters and Gary Hoffman. They've got to take a decision, which is why it's taking so much time, and why it will take even more time. Because, to be honest, it's a catch-22 situation. I don't see myself how they can get out of it. And I wouldn't be surprised if this particular takeover fell through because of it, and because there's one point at which, as well, the Saudis won't want to wait any longer. They will have had enough of the whole circus, because it is a circus.
And that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll begin with what's happening with the Football League. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's talk about the Football League. Several Championship clubs have reacted angrily to the EFL's planned restart date, the 20th of June, because full contact training has been so late to resume. Meanwhile, no one really knows what's happening with League One. Nick, well, let's start with the Championship. What's happened there? Are they all singing from the same hymn sheet in the Championship?
I think in the Championship, most of them are happy to play. It's just a matter of when and how and what the shape of their preparations will be. And as I think you've hinted there, there's a lot of consternation about the fact that certain clubs, you know, have only just started contact training or are about to, and that they've got how many days? 12 days until it supposedly kicks off. And there is a sense, I think, especially among a lot of the clubs lower down, that they're rushing it through and hurrying it through. I think they want to play, but I think they're quite concerned about a lot of the fitness and injury elements of it as well, obviously, because if you're coming back and you've got such a microwave pre-season, as I think Mick McCarthy used to call them, then you're going to have issues.
Mm. And actually, interestingly, that sort of leads to Lyle Taylor and Charlton and his decision not to play, because he's coming to the end of a contract. He doesn't want to get injured because he's got a big move. And it's, I don't really know how I feel about that, actually.
It's a difficult one, because I think, first of all, you think, could he help the club that helped him, you know, that gave him a chance to play at a level he'd never starred at before, that is right in the dogfight, that needs to win games to stay up. And he is their star striker with something like 11 goals, a goal every other game. So could he help the club that gave him that chance to get out of the relegation zone? But then you think, look, if we're looking at Lyle Taylor's specific case, he's 30 years old. And if you look at his career, you'll see what a big deal this is, because his career didn't get going until he was 25 or 26. He was, I think 5 years ago from memory, he was on loan at Partick Thistle. He'd been playing for like teams like Lewis and Eastbourne and teams like this. And and the footballers, you know, we're all guilty of it. We talk about footballers, but they're not some amorphous blob. You've got individuals with their own hopes and dreams and pasts and ambitions and neuroses and everything, like all of us. And if Lyle Taylor's been offered the contract of a lifetime somewhere, which it sounds as if he has, at 30 years old, having really had to drag himself up to this level at a point where a lot of players have been forgotten or cast off or dropped down the leagues, you see that from his point of view, that he wants to protect himself. Now, what are the chances of him getting injured in the next month or two? Higher than they would have been in a normal circumstance, I think we can say, given the slightly hashed preparation for all this. I'm not sure, but I can see it from his perspective, but I can also see why a Charlton fan would say, well, look, we need to stay up here, and our best striker, who we've given this chance to, doesn't want to play. So it's a tough one, and I think the conclusion is that we have to remember that we're dealing with individuals' lives here.
League One, Nick, can you explain what's happening and make it interesting and exciting and clear as well? And you can't say no.
Are you sitting comfortably? So we have a vote tomorrow on the fate of the season, and it should bring to a close a lot of wrangling that's gone on for a couple of months. But in reality, a lot of people are going to be left unhappy whatever happens. It is likely that around two-thirds of the clubs will vote for a points per game formula to freeze the standings more or less as they are. And then, like in League Two, only play the playoffs. League Two was decided a couple of weeks back, so you then obviously ask why League One has taken so long. But what you've got in the form of League One now, and I think this is absolutely fascinating, I think you've got a league here that is almost the battleground for the future of English football. If you look at the clubs in it, it's almost an exact split. In the top half, you've got clubs like Ipswich and Sunderland, who are both, to be honest, quite aghast to be there at all and probably see themselves as a minimum top half championship clubs. You've got clubs with Premier League pasts like Pompey and Coventry, who are both sort of on their way back. They can sense it now. And then teams like Peterborough, Doncaster, Rotherham, who've had spells in the championship and think they can establish themselves back up there. Ambitious clubs like Oxford United too. But they've got a bottom half of clubs who more or less, I think it's fair to say, are quite happy to be there. And if they're secure competing and in some cases playing Football League football at all, they're in a good place. So you've got a group of clubs in that division that have known life at the very top. And then a group that have got no belief that they'll really get up there. And they're just sort of seeking to function as a lower division club. And I think the Portsmouth CEO put it quite well a couple of weeks back when he said that the Championship is now aligning itself with the Premier League, going back a bit to what I said earlier. And League Two was aligning itself with the National League, you know, basically binning the season off to save money, basically. And let's remember that operationally, there's not a lot of difference between most League Two and National League clubs. So you can see the problem here. If you're Ipswich or Sunderland, both of whom are outside the playoff places, by the way, you want to be gravitating in one of those directions and not in the other direction. Because I think the gap between the Championship and League One, after all this, is going to get wider and wider. And I think looking down the track, maybe one or two years ahead, we're going to fast track a situation where we end up with a Premier League Two and regionalised lower divisions. And there are some clubs that will be absolutely terrified of that idea. So you've got tomorrow's vote, and you've got clubs which have tabled amendments. It's an incredibly tight division. You've got 3 points between second and eighth. And at the bottom, it's a bit clearer, but you've got Tranmere, who've got a game in hand and making a massive fight of it. Bolton and Southend have both gone. So that's where points per game seems a bit unfair, because it doesn't really take into account form or the inevitable fluctuations in a season. And we all know that the final few weeks of a season can bring some massive changes. So Tranmere have put forward an incredibly detailed formula that allows for some of those inconsistencies based on a statistical analysis of, I think, the last three seasons. And they've worked out that if you use on points per game, there could be an up to 11-point fluctuation. So that would mean that they stayed up and only two went down. But long story short, would mean eight clubs get to compete in the playoffs. clubs like Peterborough, whose chairman, Darren McAntony, has been particularly vocal, and also Sunderland would be happy with that because they're just outside the playoffs. My team, Ipswich, would miss out, but it's the nearest thing available where teams that want to play can play and teams that don't want to play don't play. And a lot of clubs are quite tempted by it, but that won't quite get enough votes. I think it's got to be 51%.
But if two go down, how many go up? Or would League One be bigger next year?
It'd be 25 teams. I don't think this will quite happen, but personally, I think it's the best way to do it. But don't forget that the financial imperatives in League One also are massively different. Like the bigger clubs can afford to play, and their biggest problems will be one that we're going to come to, I think, season ticket rebate money. That's a massive issue. Smaller clubs like Accrington have a lot of match day custom, and they'd have to take everybody off furlough to play, which is really expensive. So I think Darren McAntony did some sums that claim that there's actually not very much difference between the two in terms of financial effect, playing or not playing. But nobody really knows, and the EFL provided very, I think, poor leadership on this. My own sense personally is that the biggest risk is putting a club in cold storage now, when there's no guarantee that things will be different at all in 3 months' time, 6 months' time, a year's time, in terms of welcoming crowds. So if you don't play now, when do you play? Do you play next year? Do you play longer? It sets a very dangerous precedent, a dangerous tone. And on balance, I think they've got to play. But I also think that as a side point, a lot of this debate would not be had if the Premier League were maybe be engaged a bit more to provide some financial assistance. But as you can see there, I've rattled through a lot of different angles and nuances of it, and you're probably still no clearer.
Sure, but we are all still awake. So, you know, take the bonuses. Ed, you wanted to come in.
Really interesting. I mean, it's very sad as well to hear all this, you know, that what's trying to find a solution for a league that is so important, like Nick said, is so important for the development of young English players as well now, because, you know, the Championship has got so many expensive, big budget clubs now who are looking to get in the Premier League. So increasingly, the younger players are having to go out on loan to the League One. You know, like Harry Kane started down there, didn't he? Back in the day, and all these clubs as well have had pretty much. I mean, especially the ones down the lower end of the league and in League Two. I think I was told by a couple of clubs where they've had literally like two people have been. Have not been furloughed out of the whole club. So that includes all the recruitment staff and their academy staff, as well as, you know, the first team staff. And that's a real concern as well. What's going to happen to all the youth team players from these clubs? You know, there's just going to be cast asunder, really, I suppose. But yeah, let's hope. I think you're right, Nick. It does seem to me there has to be a solution. They need to get back playing in some form before the end of the season so they can have some kind of competition.
Philippe, you wanted to mention Sunderland and Newcastle?
Yeah, oh gosh, yes. But before that, I just wanted to bounce back on what Ed was just saying. These clubs, you know, when I hear about Tottenham Hotspur being able to borrow £175 million at almost a zero interest rate, and I'm thinking, this is crazy, you're loaning money to the people who don't need it. These are the clubs. You know, there's no reason why there couldn't be a package, a government package, for the lower division clubs. The problem is, and Nick will know that much better than I do, I don't think that there are many clubs in League One and League Two which would qualify for a AAA rating in terms of credit. In fact, most of them are pretty risky businesses, which do not necessarily turn out a profit or have a great credit rating. That's another matter. But yes, I just wanted to mention, and I think they have to be mentioned, the local enemies, Newcastle and Sunderland, whose behaviour when it comes to season tickets of their fans has been absolutely despicable in terms of basically completely ignoring the fact that the fans, especially in those areas which have been really hard, very, very hit, the fans simply haven't been proposed anything in terms of rebate or refund. And in fact, some of them have seen direct debit taken for next season's season ticket, which is quite astonishing. So a number of clubs have done the right things, even if they're taking their time. You know, for example, Arsenal will only, I think, refund by the season tickets by 28 June, something like that, which is quite late for many people, but it will happen. But Sunderland and Newcastle, unfortunately, have taken a completely different view. and which is basically to ignore their fans completely.
Now, in the WSL, Chelsea were awarded the Women's Super League title on a points-per-game formula after the season was curtailed. Liverpool were relegated. Aston Villa were promoted. There are lots of things to unpick from the women's game, and we're going to give it proper time next Monday on the pod. All right, let's cross to Germany and talk about the Bundesliga and say hello to Archie Rinter. Archie, how are you doing?
Very well, Max. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm marvellous. Thanks very much. More Black Lives Matter protests in the Bundesliga this weekend. What happened?
Yeah, so you had Bayern Munich wearing T-shirts before their game against Bayer Leverkusen, and then during the game they were wearing armbands which said Black Lives Matters on it. You also had Borussia Dortmund and Hertha Berlin on Saturday night all taking a knee before their game. And on Sunday as well, it happened before Union Berlin against Schalke and Werder Bremen against Wolfsburg. But even in the Union Berlin against Schalke game, you had referee Tobias Stieler joining in as well, which was the only time that we saw a referee join in with it during the weekend. And this all came after, during the week, we had the DFB president Fritz Keller saying that there would be no sanctions taken against the players last weekend who had protested, the likes of Weston McKennie, Jadon Sancho, Marcus Thuram and Anthony Modest. So I think that the Bundesliga has handled it very well, but there are obvious contradictions to be seen within the league in terms of, okay, great that they're tackling this issue like this, but Bayern's links to Qatar still stand out. The fact that Schalke president Clemens Tönnies made openly racist comments against Africans back in August, it doesn't really sit well amongst the backdrop of all this. So there's still work to be done, but it's a great gesture to see from the players itself. I think that distinction needs to be made as well.
I think you're right. We're going to do much more on this on tomorrow's podcast. Timo Werner to Chelsea. A lot of us have seen some of Timo Werner. Some of us would have seen a lot of Timo Werner, but for those listening who don't know a lot about him, what have Chelsea got?
A very quick and good finisher who has really kicked on since he moved from Stuttgart to Leipzig a few years ago, particularly under Julian Nagelsmann, where there were doubts before this season whether he could play in a team which had a lot of the ball. He seemed like something of a counter-attacking merchant, if that's a possible concept. But under Nagelsmann, his movement in the area has improved. I remember speaking to Nagelsmann early in the season saying that he wanted to improve his movement in those small spaces around the box, and it's bought him, I think, 5 or 6 more goals this season. He's on 25. He got an assist at the weekend, but understandably, he wasn't available for any interviews. But Nagelsmann, he didn't say that it's all done, but he said that there's 3 or 4 more other players in the squad who also have release clauses, so it's something that they just have to put up with.
Tell us about the games themselves. Bayern Munich coming from behind against Bayer Leverkusen. A lot of the focus on Kai Havertz, whether he's injured or whether he's not injured.
And he was injured. So say the club. He picked up an injury against Freiburg last weekend, and it kind of started circulating round the stadium, to the 3 or 4 of us that were there, that he was injured very shortly before the team news came out, which surprised everyone because Leverkusen had kept that very quiet. But Peter Bosch told me that it was something that the Leverkusen coach told me it was a knee injury, but it's not a matter of weeks, it should be days. Still, Leverkusen beat Bayern earlier in the season without Havertz in the starting lineup, and they took the lead through Lucas Alario. But I think even the way that they scored that goal, it was a millimeter VAR offside decision. It showed the margins that you have to be inside to score against Bayern right now. And Hansi Flick, the Bayern coach, said after the game that he was almost glad for this challenge for his team to overcome. And once again, they overcame it in stunning fashion. They were leading 3-1 by half time. Kingsley Coman, Serge Gnabry, and Leon Goretzka all scoring. And then after the break, you had Robert Lewandowski. A few records broken. Robert Lewandowski has 44 goals in all competitions, I believe, for the campaign, meaning that he's broken his own personal record. He's got 30 goals in a Bundesliga season for the third time now. 30's his record, so he's got another few games to break it. But he and Thomas Müller are going to be out suspended against Gladbach next weekend. But Thomas Müller equaled the all-time assist record for the Bundesliga with his 19th and 20th assists of the season. And if all those records aren't enough, you've got the fact that Bayern are bearing down on the all-time goals record in a Bundesliga season, 101. They need 12 more in their final four games. And the way that they're playing, I wouldn't bet against them doing that. One more record that I need to mention. Florian Wirtz, at 17 years of age, with his consolation goal for Leverkusen, became the youngest Bundesliga goal scorer ever, beating the record of Nuri Sahin back in the 2005-2006 season. He is a player to watch.
Now, Archie, you're coming on the pod for the whole of Thursday, aren't you? So we will do a lot more Bundesliga then.
Yes.
Excellent. Thanks for coming on. Yes, Archie will be with us on Thursday alongside Sid in Spain and Nicky Bandini as we do our very own version of Euro Trash. Tomorrow we're going to do a special on football's reaction to George Floyd. The same panel we had on the day after the Bulgaria game. Moussa Okwonga from Stadio, Troy Townsend from Kick It Out, and the writer Elliot Ross. Philippe, quickly, you wanted to talk about Gianni Infantino's comments.
Well, there's some interesting news with Gianni Infantino, by the way. There's been a complaint made to the Swiss justice against him because he's basically accused to have encouraged Michel Lauber, the Swiss prosecutor, to violate the secret of instruction, to have abused power and so forth. So he's not in a good place. I was trying to think of an organization which is behaving more as an imperialistic and colonialistic way that FIFA has been since Infantino has been in power, and I can't. It's quite extraordinary. I think it's something which is absolutely amazing when you realize that Infantino was elected in February 2016. I don't think 6 months had passed before he decided to disband the anti-racism task force because he considered the job had been done. Do you remember that, Max? And also, when it comes to the way the affairs of FIFA have been conducted, the way that they basically are a kind of imperium run from Zurich. And I find the discourse of it so hypocritical, I just don't know what to say, which is why, you know, maybe I shouldn't even speak about it, because it drives me speechless when I hear FIFA having this discourse about what is happening at the moment, about the conversation, as it were, and not realizing or not acknowledging the fact that it is very much part of the problem. When I look at the governing body of the sport I love and that we all love, and the example it has set, and then suddenly, you know, coming on the side of the angels, when it's, in fact it has been on the other side for as long as I can remember. I mean, it's extraordinary. And especially this particular regime. Look at what it did to African football last August, when it basically took over. That's how much, you know, they care about things. They took over. I mean,
the way they've reacted to the Haiti story. I mean, he's been eventually suspended.
Absolutely. And how long it took for them. And only because there was this huge pressure and because of the work you and Alex and Romain did and the way it was taken on. And the way that, for example, they're behaving with the Trinidad and Tobago Federation at the moment. The way they normalize them. The way they're ignoring what's happening in Kenya. The way they've been working in particular with African FAs over the past few years, when they've been normalizing everybody in sight, everybody, you know, and at the same time ignoring the problems, the real problems, and to hear, to have lessons of morals and ethics and respect given by these people, I am disgusted, and I don't know.
It's certainly something that, you know, there's lots to talk about on tomorrow's podcast, and it's what we're going to do then. Before we finish part two, I really wanted to send all of our thoughts to Mark Chapman, the Five Live and BBC broadcaster. heartbreaking news about his wife passing away yesterday after a long illness. He is not only a brilliant broadcaster, in my opinion, but is a good man. And we send our sympathies to him, and we'll be back in a minute. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Ed, your book, Made in Africa. How nice was it? We were talking before the pod about how long it's taking to write this book, and how nice a moment is it to have a physical copy of it in your hand?
Amazing feeling, to be honest. As you said, it's more than 5 years in the making, really, I think, going back to when I lived in South Africa for the World Cup for a couple of years. And just struck me that, you know, all the players that I've watched when I was growing up, you know, from, I've mentioned this a lot this week, but Tony Yeboah and Peter Unleve, they're the two for me that were really, and later on there are lots of other players, but those two in particular from my sort of formative years. And I just thought that it was something that needed to be recognised, really, because it's, you know, not been before. And yeah, I'm very proud to have it out there at the moment. And some of the reaction I've been getting from various parts of Africa has been really like made me think that it was, you know, worth all that effort. I'm yeah, really pleased.
Why do you think it's a story that hasn't often been told?
I think this is a similar, you know, this is a debate that's going on at the moment, isn't it? That lots of histories aren't taught in the Western world. And, you know, this is just the latest example of that. You know, like we've had lots of books on various different countries coming to, you know, the players that have come to England. Like Philippe is here, and I remember when I was a much younger man reading his book about Cantona and being really inspired by that, you know. And then wanting to do the same thing for African players, because they are underrepresented in wider society, and not just players, but African culture as well. Very important to our society in the UK these days. And I think that's something that we need to recognise more. And that's, you know, a lot of the protests have been trying to make the same sort of point, that, you know, in school, we're always taught the same. If those of us who are born and brought up in England, as someone was saying on Twitter, you know, we're taught the Tudors, and then we skip all of that era, the slavery era and all of that, and go straight into the Second World War and things like that, you know, and there's a massive, massive gaps in people's knowledge. And I mean, I'm not saying that this is going to redress those kind of things, but, you know, I'd like people to know what some of the things that some of these early players especially had to go through, really, to create the opportunities for the modern player.
The backstories of some of these players, even you know, the current players, even, you know, Sadio Mane and Mo Salah, that their backstories are more interesting than the backstories of players who were born here, because not all the time, but very often, there's much more of a struggle to make it as a professional footballer.
Exactly, and that's one of the things that Jurgen Klopp said to me at the very start of the book, is that that's what makes African players, you know, more determined, that they've had to overcome such obstacles to make it. You know, you think about not just Mane and Salah, but they're the really famous examples of there. You know, everybody knows now about Mane, how he had to run away from home because of his family were very religious and didn't want him to be a footballer. And Salah was supported a lot more by his family, but slightly from a slightly better back, you know, more wealthy background, not much more, but a bit more, but still had to travel 8 hours to get to training, you know, and then back to training. And me and Nick actually went to his hometown for the book, and then we saw how much of a journey that was, even in a hire car. So, you know, having to do that every day on the bus. But yeah, it's not just those two. You know, it's pretty much every African player, even today in the Premier League, you look at what they've had to overcome. It's quite astonishing, really. And I think it's still the case, sadly, that you need to be better than your counterpart if you're an African. Because to make it all the way to, you know, a different continent and to the very top, I think you have to, you're still fighting against prejudice as well and racism, really, even at football clubs, in among coaching staff. And, you know, some, you know, we've seen Cheku Kayate said a couple of years ago about that scandal about West Ham and the way that African players were dismissed by their former director of football. And that just shows you there are these attitudes that still pervade some levels of football, you know, and so I think that's why we need to show a lot of respect to the African players that make it, not just in England, but around the world.
You begin with Arthur Wharton, right? The first African to play football in England. And as you say, extraordinary to be born in Africa in the 1860s and become a professional sportsman anywhere, but also like extraordinary to make it in the north of England.
Yeah, it's a bit of an unusual story, because he was actually from, well, he was a massively mixed descent. He had some sort of Scottish blood in him, but also Ghanaian royalty, like Fante royal family blood in him. So, and he originally came over to England to study to be a missionary or to be a priest, like the rest of his family. And it was really frowned upon, in fact, like the sporting career at that time. This was just before the sort of era of, you know, Victorian sporting greatness, and especially amongst the non-white community, you were just encouraged to be, you know, follow the three C's, which was Christianity and more Christianity, basically. But he was also a 100 meters world record holder as well, just before he became a goalkeeper for the local football teams, and also played cricket to a reasonably high level too. So he was an unbelievable sportsman, and really. But the thing about him I'd like to say is that his name was forgotten pretty much until about 1995. And it was only because of the work of a historian who heard about him called Phil Vasali. And he's done lots of great work on the first black players in the UK. He effectively dug up his story and brought it to life. And, you know, 20 years later, we now have a statue of him at St. George's Park, England's, the FA's National Training Centre. And that's the kind of, you know, respect that a pioneer like that should have.
And actually, like, I mean, statues is a very relevant topic, isn't it? And the struggles to get that statue up, the story is quite extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty mad. When I first heard the involvement, I mean, it's got Stevie Wonder in it, which kind of... Yeah. And, you know, Stevie Wonder, I'm not sure if he's aware of this thing. You know, he was the real catalyst for getting some momentum behind the campaign to have statues of Arthur Wharton. Not only, we were talking about FIFA before, there's actually a statue of Arthur Wharton at FIFA's headquarters in Zurich, which was hand-delivered by Sean Campbell, and also at UEFA and at the FA and everywhere else. And you know, a statue is one thing, and like going on to another character, Albert Johansson's daughter, who played for Leeds, you know, almost 100 years later, she said to me, the most important thing, statues are good, but the most important thing is education. And she is trying to, and like a lot of the biographers of these players that I speak to, the early ones, are trying to get out there to teach their stories to people, because that's the most important thing, that we learn from the way that these guys were treated, and that we ensure that kind of thing doesn't happen again, and that it's more of a level playing field for people. Because, you know, that's the most important thing, that we learn from our mistakes in history.
In the book, there's a player called Steve Kalamazoo Makoni. Kalamazoo is his nickname, and the first black South African to play professional football in England. And there's a really, well, two things that really strike me from him. One, the funny story of a Geordie ringing him up in the 50s and him not being able to understand a word he was saying down the phone. And the second about the institutional racism that he met when playing for Coventry, but the sort of crowds being bigger who wanted to see him, and this idea that football fans can support a black player, but yet still hold really trenchant racist views. And I had a row on Twitter with a Leeds fan this week about the EU, who mentioned the word swarms when it came to immigrants, and I picked him up on it. And yet his bio is, you know, in Bielsa we trust. It still exists, right? And I think that's what's fascinating about it.
I've never been able to get my head around that, how you can, you know, idolise a black player or a Muslim player or whatever from your team, and then racially abuse someone from another team, or you know, not in the football context, just in a Twitter context, or, you know, whatever. It just doesn't add up to me. But Steve Makoni is a very interesting character, as well as his career in England was actually quite brief, and it was great. I spoke to a lot of people that remembered watching him, like Bobby Gould, who was obviously went on to be a Coventry legend and played for them and managed them. And he was a kid and he used to watch him, and he just, the first time he'd ever seen a black player, definitely, and, you know, just has never forgotten that. And but then Steve McConey's life, unfortunately, after he left England, took a bit of a strange turn. It's quite a crazy story, really. I spent a lot of time on that chapter, to the extent I almost wrote another book on it, actually. But it's a mad story, because he ends up in prison in America, and there's lots of sort of conspiracy theories around, and said that he played for Barcelona and didn't. What I try to do throughout the book is tell people's stories and not take sides in any way. At the end of all this, I want people to realise that he may have had some faults, like all men do and all women do, but he was a pioneer, and I think a lot of his issues later came from some of his treatment in his earlier life.
And I had no idea that Mark Steen and Brian Steen were born in South Africa.
Yeah, and Edwin Steen, their oldest brother as well, who was amazing with this. And yeah, and that's a kind of a good example of stories that are unknown, and I really wanted people to know that, because their dad was an absolute hero of the ANC, who was exiled, having been placed under house arrest by the apartheid system. Him and his wife went on hunger strike. And then, Brian is the middle one. They were all born in South Africa and then moved to England where in the 60s when Edwin was about 11. And Edwin as well, which is something a lot of people won't know, but he's the first black manager in English Football League. When he managed Barnet and got the promotion. He took over from Barry Fry. He was Barry Fry's long-term assistant. But that family, you know, three players to have played professionally. One became a manager, Brian Steen. Played for England. He was the first black African born player to play for England. Only played once against France, Michel Platini's France, in 1984, and they lost. And that was it for Brian. And then also Mark, who played for Chelsea and has spoken out a lot against racism in the past over the years. To have three from the same family that, you know, and their dad was this amazing man who was actually not the biggest sports fan by the sounds of it, but used sport to, you know, disrupt the apartheid regime. And was very a good friend of Peter Haynes in the 70s, and they used to go to Twickenham and put moles in the pitch to disrupt the matches and things like that. But just some amazing stories. And he's you know, Edwin, like a lot of the people that I met, was just so humble about this and was a bit surprised about why I wanted to write the story about his dad. And it was like, this, you know, this is the sort of thing that people need to know about, because you know, nothing to do with me, but I'm kind of proud of the fact that, you know, that family has made such an impact in the country, and we're able to do what they did.
Ed, do you think that the Premier League and its clubs are lagging behind a bit other countries in the pathway they can offer to African players coming in? Because I'm thinking about France, for example, which I think Philippe will obviously be more qualified to talk about. And France has got obviously a very complex relationship with its colonial past, but there is at least a bit more sort of economic and social relationships going on. So you've got, for example, in football, you've got Mane coming from Generation Foot in Senegal, and you've got the link with Metz and things like that. And you don't really get that where Premier League clubs are concerned. You don't get too many link-ups with African academies or clubs or countries. Like the nearest one in recent years that I can think of in England is Manchester City and the Right to Dream Academy, where they were farming kids out to, I think, Nordsjælland in Denmark, and it got a bit controversial. And I visited a few years ago Craig Bellamy's academy in Sierra Leone, which, while it lasted, was an excellent endeavour scuppered by the Ebola crisis, actually. But I just think there is surely scope for the kind of pathway that French clubs are getting very much involved in Francophone Africa.
Yeah, I think so. But the big issue is work permits in terms of getting players in. Earlier, I think we're starting to see a bit of a trend now of some players coming slightly earlier than they, because traditionally, you know, if you look back over most of the African players who've come in have been a bit older than maybe clubs would prefer, you know, they're like 24 up, but now we're maybe starting to see them come a little bit earlier, but it just takes that length of time to make the progression from Africa, then going to, you know, all of the players pretty much in the modern storyline in my book with you know, Salah and Mane and Kaito have had to go through that, you know, intermediary stage before they get to England, and it is a big hindrance is the work permit situation. I mean, I saw you did a great interview with Patson Daka last week at Red Bull Salzburg, and all those guys, you know, they are being groomed to come to the Premier League at a younger age, at sort of 22, 23, and going to have a real impact as well, I think. And I've said this quite a lot this week, but it's great to see number of different African countries now producing young players that, you know, perhaps you are not known as the heavyweights like Ivory Coast, Nigeria, Algeria, Egypt, but you know, places like Zambia and Mali as well, which are producing so many good young players at the moment. I think we're going to see that in the next few years. It's going to be a real rise in those kind of countries.
Just to take on what Nick and Ed, it's actually, it's also a question to Ed, by the way, because it is true that there is a pathway which has been put in place by a number of French clubs, like and not necessarily big clubs, like Angoulême, for example, was very important, and also Belgian clubs. But it works, it cuts both ways, because on one hand, it gives players from French-speaking Africa, this is what we're talking about, it gives them a possibility to to go somewhere and to have a professional career, which explains the huge number of players who have African players who have played in Ligue 1 for a number of years. And something which is, by the way, is also reflected in the number of players of African origin who've played for France. And, you know, the first one was Raoul Diagne. We're talking the 1920s. And there has been a steady stream. It's always been like this. It's always,
because Jules Fontaine won the Golden Boot.
And he was born in Casablanca. And Rachid Mekloufi also played for France before he joined the FLN team for Algeria. And there are plenty of examples. But what I would say is that it cuts both ways, because there is always a degree in exploitation, in any case, with young footballers. Whatever their race is, there is a degree of exploitation. But in the case of African football, the question is to be asked, the way you look at the way French clubs and Belgian clubs have been working with youngsters in Senegal, in Mali, wherever, you've got to look at it. Some of it has been excellent. Not all of it has been excellent. So I was going to say it cuts both ways in a way. That's a very difficult and delicate relationship, which is, by the way, when you talk about the delicate relationship France has got with its former colonies, yes, it is very, very delicate to say the least. One of the reasons being that an awful lot of people from the so-called métropole were colons who lived in African countries. There were far more French citizens who came and settled in African countries than there were British.
Oh, a lot more.
British.
Yeah.
I mean, it's no comparison.
And I think that's why it's interesting, just as 2 points I want to make. So I spoke to Divock Origi's uncle, who is called Austin Adore, and he's like the start of a generation of great Kenyan players. And he was the first one, and his younger brother, Mike Origi, ended up going to Genk in Belgium, and that's how Divock was born in Belgium and ended up playing for them. But I spoke to Austin about it. He said at the time, you know, for English-speaking countries, there was no pathway for us. We had to go to a French-speaking country. And you look at JJ Okocha, he went to Germany, and Michael Essien, even that late, went to Lyon. So that's a lot later, because there wasn't that much of a pathway. But an interesting point to make, and Nick was here in the interview I did with this guy, Seah Seck, who's he set up the Diambars Academy with Patrick Vieira in 2003, and he's now the vice president of the Senegalese FA. And a really impressive guy, and he put it on the table. We want to win the World Cup, was one thing that he said. But the other, they're kind of aiming very high. But the other really interesting thing that he said was how he still feels that African, the young players that they produce are not being, they're not being recompensed to the right amount. You know, they're kind of still undervalued by the rest of the world. He did a comparison of the best Brazilian player who goes, you know, teenager who goes for sort of 50 million euros to Real Madrid, or the best young African player, they're lucky to get €500,000 for him. So he thinks there's still that kind of imbalance in the system, and Africa is at the bottom of the pile, really. So that's something that needs to change. And I think hopefully in the next few years, some of these academies will start, you know, being more equal partners, because, you know, turning somebody like Wilfred Ndidi went from a local club in Nigeria to Genk. And then in 18 months, you know, he went for €500,000. And in 18 months, he sold for €20 million. And that profit that Genk make, although they have done a lot for his career to embed it, you know, get him used to European football and stuff, surely the club that helped develop him in the first place should be also getting a bit more of that.
Finally, Ed, and most importantly, and I will judge you entirely on this, which goal is better, Yeboah v Liverpool or Yeboah v Wimbledon?
Now, that is a question.
I don't think there's a debate. I'm not going to say I don't think there's a debate to it.
I think I've always thought Liverpool, to be honest. That was the one that really...
Thank you so much.
I think the Wimbledon one, there was an element of, like, you know, he didn't necessarily mean that knee. You know that knee when he, like, Yeah. Anyway, I watched it again yesterday and decided for certain. But I think I'd already decided, to be honest.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, and I don't think there's a debate. And if anybody thinks it's the Wimbledon goal, I recommend you go to another football podcast. well, good luck with the book, Ed. It's fascinating, and thanks for telling us all about it. And I'll tweet out about it, etc., etc. And that will do for today's pod. Ed, thank you.
Thank you very much. Been a pleasure.
Thank you, Philippe.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nick.
Thank you, Max.
And we'll be back tomorrow when we will look at football's reaction to George Floyd and the protests around the UK and around the world.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.